I want to remind you something about the past, what grids means, how it affects all the future planning for decades for this city. Mayor Larry Deani did an explanation on grids. I want you to listen closely to the fact that he says all our future plans are tied to these grids processes. They cannot be changed in the future. Now that's the key sentence that bothers me, because with what's going on at the Aerotropolis and the money going into Highway 6, the future plans for Hamilton as a transportation hub, in light of all the news we're getting from everywhere outside of Hamilton, that fuel is dwindling, jobs are being lost as a result of it, and jet fuel is very hard to replace. We are one of the few communities that are still pushing ahead, basing our future economic growth on truck transportation and cargoes by jet. We have a wonderful port. We used to have a great rail line. They are brownfields. They're already industrial. They already have hookups for hydroelectricity and water. I don't understand why the city isn't focusing on that direction more. But rather than make suggestion, I'm just going to let you listen once again what the city planned when they were talking about grids, the future directions, and how everything would be locked up after these plans were initiated.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
We have 6 grids in this city. They all tie around one area, that is the airport. It's key for every single plan. If you want to know more about grids, you have to go to the City Hall web pages and do some reading. Grids are important. It's how we plan our future. Jane Jacobs pointed out that how we plan our zoning also is important to our cities. We're at a crossroads right now, and we have to pay attention to what we're doing. We're making a major change in our grids. So let's go back and listen to where this all began.
Telling you that grids, of course, is the most comprehensive and complex planning exercise ever conducted in Hamilton. A decision on grids will be one of the most difficult, perhaps, but certainly one of the most far-reaching decisions ever made by a local council. This has been, for the last 3 years, an integrated planning process. And, of course, that means that council's decisions on a preferred growth option will be the foundation for all future planning, policy, and financing of new land use, community services, water and wastewater utilities, road transportation, transit, and stormwater management for our city. Once the grid's decision is made, those follow-up actions, plans, and strategies become a package. And as a package, future councils will not be able to change one aspect, remove or redirect parts of that package without affecting everything else. As I said, this is an integrated planning process that is synergistic, one aspect with the other. And so to help us make the best decision for this community, we have engaged staff now for a long period of time, members of council, members of the public. They, in turn, have sought the advice of experts in their field as well. And it all has culminated and is culminating in the report that we have received and that's before us today. Let me just quickly observe that for us, this report is not about where Hamilton grows, but more importantly, it's about how Hamilton grows and how Hamilton has grown over the last 25 to 30 years, I believe, will change with this particular approach. In fact, I would say that it must change if the local growth patterns, which have been out of line with what we see in the rest of Central Ontario, are to change. I would also say, members of council, that in fact, when the pluses and minuses of community growth over the last 25 to 30 years are taken into account, Hamilton's performance has not been sustainable and has clearly not served our best interests. And we can get into the debate on that as we hear from not only the public but our experts as well. But just to put a point on that issue, The majority of new housing we know constructed in Hamilton has been occupied by people from Halton and Peel regions, looking for cheaper or higher quality homes, and hopefully a better quality of life as well in our community. Homes that they cannot get in their own communities. The rapid growth of these commuter households has reversed the daily pattern of traffic across the city of Hamilton. Our commuter deficit has grown at a rate that doubles in size every 5 years. And despite the city's strong residential growth, Hamilton has essentially been stuck in neutral when it comes to the number of local jobs. And our successful efforts to grow the economy in one area has been continually undermined by restructuring somewhere else. And so the city's ratio of employed to non-working population, a key indicator of community health and prosperity, has fallen from over 50% in the early 80s to around 40% today. And that, I know, is a statistic that startles and concerns every single member of council. So that's an unusually rapid and negative trend, which I believe the grid's effort will reverse and tries to reverse. But it can only be corrected by two things: demanding that neighborhood communities provide enough affordable housing and a full range of social services to their own dependent people, and by greatly increasing Hamilton's rate of job growth to reduce our local dependency. We need to work with senior levels of government to allow us to do that, but we need to come to a firm, bold decision as a council on the path of growth over the next 25 to 30 years. And we will be able, members of council, to talk more specifically about that and debate some of those issues once we hear the presentations. That, I think, provides for me a context for us, and I look forward now to hearing from Steve, first of all, and then from members of the public. Yes, Councillor.
Mr. Mayor, before we lose the essence of what you started off with in your opening few sentences, don't you think this process should have been put before the electorate as an election issue?
Well, Councillor, every process that we engage in is subject to the final judgment of the people at election time. And we'll hear from staff as to why this process that's been in the works for 3 years is before us today. And I personally am quite comfortable with that.
I won't belabor this, Mr. Mayor, but I'm not comfortable with it, because I believe this is driven by the development industry. And if we had an election where there were no corporate or development donations and we kept it down to the information that's in this, I think that would be a fair... Well, I think we're being asked a lot today.
We are being asked a lot. We're being asked to produce a blueprint for this community for the next 25 and 30 years. And I would personally not want to politicize the staff report. There will be plenty of opportunity to do that in any electoral process that may that will ensue, not may ensue. So, members of council, with your permission, then, let me turn to Steve Robichaux and ask him to take us through the report.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would just like to point out, although I'm sort of the manager of grids, I represent a larger project team that's comprised of staff from the Planning Department, the Economic Development Department, the Public Works Department, the Finance Department, Community and Public Health Departments, as well as other emergency service staff departments, as well as we've had representation from the school boards and the conservation authorities throughout this process. So it has been a collaborative effort by all of the city departments and our partner agencies in developing this growth strategy. So what I'm going to do is go through a very brief presentation that outlines how we got to the recommendation that's before committee today, as opposed to the entire history of the grids process. September 2003, Council adopted the study design for grids after consultation, that 6 months of consultation on that study design. That study design outlined a time frame for the completion of grids. It was originally envisioned that the study would take approximately 24 months, but because of some changes at the provincial landscape, it took a little bit longer than originally anticipated. Specifically, now the province requires municipalities to engage in growth management studies. That's very clear in the Provincial Places to Grow plan. That plan outlines the process in which municipalities are to do that study and the factors and considerations that go into those growth management studies. In addition, since the grid study design was adopted, there's been other provincial policies and guidelines to consider. In particular, the new provincial policy statement came out, which was a much more stronger with the provincial policy-led planning regime, as well as one of the other considerations was the Greenbelt plan that really restricted the range of options in terms of where the city could grow. It had implications when we were looking at growth options as they would have related to the communities of Bimbrook or Waterdown, as well as East Mountain, Hamilton, Stony Creek area. So GRIDS is the city's growth management strategy to plan for the changing demographic and economic landscape in the province, as well as GRIDS is the integrated growth management strategy that provides the key link between Vision 2020 and the city's new official plan, as well as the other strategic documents such as the infrastructure master plans. GRIDS is the process in which the broad principles and concepts outlined in that Vision 2020 process can be translated into a land use infrastructure planning process. Provinces establish growth forecasts, and under the Places to Grow plan, municipalities are required to use those provincial growth forecasts in their growth management strategies. Under those provincial forecasts, a range of population, household, employment forecasts were prepared for the City of Hamilton, and those forecasts show that the City of Hamilton will grow between 150 and 190,000 people in the 2001 to 2031 time period. Those population would translate into between 80 to 100,000 new housing units and 90 to 100,000 new jobs. In addition, those forecasts also contain projections relating to a variety of housing types in terms of low, medium, and high-density housing. And we know that there's already room for some growth within the existing urban area of the City of Hamilton on vacant but unyet-developed land, as well as through residential intensification. At the beginning of the GRIDS process, it was decided to test what would it mean to grow it to the higher number, 190,000 people, as well as looking at the 80,000 people. At the present time, based on an assessment of the residential intensification opportunities in our existing vacant but undeveloped areas of the City of Hamilton, there's room for approximately 59,000 units. That would represent between 60 to 75% of the projected growth in Hamilton over the next 25 years. In addition, the provincial growth forecasts also contain forecasts relating to employment in terms of major office, population-related, and employment land-type employment, that being industrial manufacturing warehousing employment. The difference between those two forecasts, the compact and more compact, actually is one is more urban in nature, and the more compact forecast has a higher level of office employment projected. The manufacturing industrial level of projection is fairly consistent among those two projections, being 49 to 52,000 jobs over the next 25 to 30 years. The development of the final recommended preferred growth option occurred in three phases. Step one was to develop a series of growth concepts that looked at how we could grow in terms of alternative methods of growth and sort of academic constructs in terms of how growth could be accommodated, whether that would be a business as usual model to the other end of the continuum would be to build to the limit and stop. Public consultation on those growth concepts occurred in early 2005, and council adopted a series of growth concepts to carry forward into the GRIDS process. Those growth concepts were then translated into a series of mapped growth options, and that process was, we had public consultation on those mapped growth options in November and December 2005, and that led to the identification of the preferred growth option where we are today. The growth concepts that were developed, these are the six growth concepts that were developed and assessed using the triple bottom line evaluation process, and as I indicated, three concepts were recommended to go forward. The appropriately distributed development model that would have residential and employment land accommodated both within the existing urban area and through a series of strategically targeted urban boundary expansions. The downtown focus and nodes and corridors concepts were actually combined into one option to be carried forward, in which that growth would be encouraged and directed towards the downtown and the downtowns of the former communities, and that those downtowns would be connected by a series of corridors that would support public transit and mixed use activities along those corridors. And the third concept to be carried forward was no urban boundary expansion for the purposes of accommodating residential growth. Under the no urban boundary expansion, all of the projected population and household growth would be accommodated within the existing urban area, which would involve a shift in consumer preferences away from low-density housing, singles and semis, and towards more medium and higher-density forms of housing. Under the no urban boundary expansion option, an urban boundary expansion would be required in order to accommodate our projected employment growth within the City of Hamilton over the next 25 years. Those growth concepts were then translated into a series of growth options. The option one was the no urban boundary expansion. Three options were generated to assess distributed development for the simple reason that there was more land available for consideration for growth than was required on any one single option. And then the fifth option was the downtown nodes and corridors option. These are the options here that were presented to Council in the fall of 2005 and subject to the public consultation. As I indicated, we had the three appropriately distributed development options in that residential growth would be accommodated in areas adjacent to the existing urban area. Under each of those options, we also include the Lower Stony Creek lands, as that was already being decided by Council for an urban boundary expansion. That would be approximately about 2,500 households would be accommodated in the Lower Stony Creek area. Under option two, all of the growth would be directed to one area, what we refer to as the hockey stick at the Alfreda area. And then two options looked at distributing that growth adjacent to the existing urban areas throughout the City of Hamilton. this is the no urban boundary expansion option, and just and that there would be the expansion for the employment areas in and around the airport, and this also incorporated the lower Stony Creek urban boundary expansions. And then the fifth option was the nodes and corridors option. The difference primarily between option 5 and option 2 related to the amount of intensification. Options 2, 3, and 4 assumed that there would be about 26 to 27,000 units accommodated through residential intensification. Option 5 built on that amount of residential intensification and also looked at the feasibility of assigning or directing even higher levels of intensification to a series of nodes throughout the community. Public consultation occurred on those growth options as well as the circulation to the technical agencies, and a report we reported back to Council in March of this year on that public consultation. The public indicated their support for an integrated planning process. There was the conditional support for intensification. There were comments and concerns relating about how much intensification, where would that intensification look like, what would it mean for their existing neighborhood communities. There was concerns about loss of green space or the loss of the open space areas within those communities. And there was also strong support for the importance of good urban design and architectural control when dealing with intensification. One of the comments that came back was that the people liked the idea of option one, no urban boundary expansion, but questioned, is it realistic? Based provincial policy regime, would it be possible for the municipality to say, no, this is how we are going to accommodate our growth, notwithstanding what the province is saying in terms of the projected nature of growth? The Pleasant View area, that being the rural area in Dundas, there was very strong opinions both for and against Pleasant View. There was a strong contingency who felt that development should occur in Pleasant View, and there was other very strong contingency that felt that Pleasant View, because of its environmental considerations, no development should occur there, and that given the fact that it went through a very extensive OMB review process in the early 1990s, that OMB decision should be respected on any further growth management planning. There was strong support for the nodes and corridors concept, as well as for support of encouraging and facilitating public transit in the growth management strategy. The public indicated that the city can and must do better in terms of greenfield development, in terms of the physical layout and design of the new neighborhoods and communities, as well as the linkages in terms of those greenfield development in terms of residential growth with non-residential growth in those areas, the infrastructure to support the neighborhoods, as well as ensuring that the road network and other matters can support the population growth. The public indicated that they did support the triple bottom line approach in terms of how it looked at both community economic and ecological well-being as part of very important considerations on a go-forward basis, as well as we heard that the issues of employment growth and providing employment lands within the city was very important, especially as it related to job housing balance, because there was a concern that if current trends continued, Hamilton would in effect become a bedroom community of the larger GTA. Based on the public comments that we received, the comments from the technical agencies, as well as a more detailed evaluation of the five growth options, staff undertook a triple bottom line evaluation to assess how did each of those growth options relate to those desired outcome statements around the themes of community, economic, and ecological well-being. As a result of that TBL evaluation process, option 5, which was the nodes and corridors option, was seen as the best option for supporting the triple bottom line objectives and implementing the type of community envisioned under Vision 2020. However, during that more technical detailed evaluation, as well as some of the feedback from the public and the agencies, there was a recognition that the Preferred Growth Option Act needed some modifications to it. Those modifications related to the provincial growth forecasts, the natural heritage system update that was being done as part of the development of the new official plan, in particular for the rural area. Corridors, as it related to Centennial Parkway and Upper James Highway 6 area. Corridors, in order to be, or mixed-use corridors, in order for them to be effective, have to be mixed-use, as well as having activity on both sides of the roads, as opposed to being single-loaded. There was the deferral 11 area was identified as a concern in the sense that that area was not originally included within the growth options. The deferral 11 area is the area bounded by 20 Road, the airport, Highway 6 Upper James, and Glencaster Road, and that's an outstanding matter from when the regional official plan was adopted in the early 1990s. Comments, and there was analysis about the amount of residential intensification. As part of that study, a demand and supply analysis has been undertaken in terms of making sure that the amount of residential intensification that's being planned for is realistic, as well as where should that residential intensification occur to make sure that it supports other policy objectives. And the final matter that was brought into consideration related to peak oil or other energy considerations. In terms of the growth forecasts, the province is in the November version of the Places to Grow plan has clarified that only the growth forecasts contained in the Places to Grow document are to be used for the purposes of municipal planning and growth management strategies. Specifically, as that related to the City of Hamilton, we have to use the compact forecast, which projects a population of 660,000 by 2031, which translates into a demand for 80,000 additional households. The primary difference between the compact and the more compact growth forecast is that the the compact is less urban in composition in that although you basically have the same number of low-density housing units, the difference comes that you have less apartment units and less medium-density or townhouse units on a go-forward basis. The land supply was further refined, and we get to that approximately 60,000 dwelling units that can be accommodated within the existing urban area over the next 25 to 30 years. In addition, as part of the development of the new City of Hamilton official plan, a lot of work has been going into the mapping and the identification of our natural heritage system. That mapping and work, it relates to both information being provided by the province through the Greenbelt, the various elements for consideration in the new provincial policy statement, as well as through the own city's database in terms of identifying and protecting what is important. The natural heritage system mapping has been the subject of two rounds of public consultation in order to obtain feedback. And one of the considerations that comes out of this is as we start identifying and protecting more green space areas, then that removes lands that can be available for consideration in terms of urban development, which means that compensating lands have to be provided elsewhere. And that actually changes the balance between the amount of land that's available for development within any urban boundary expansion and the amount of land that gets set aside to be protected on an ongoing basis. Fourth, the other consideration related to the Deferral 11 area, and that was that came out of the discussions in summer of 2005 relating to the airport study area. At the time of the adoption of Special Policy Area 9 in and around the airport, several other factors were also done. The existing airport influence area was mapped and to be identified in order to prevent the encroachment of sensitive land uses or non-compatible land uses under the airport noise influence areas. And in doing so, the airport influence area was extended west in terms of mapping it. That area had been described in the regional official plan, but a map was not there. So in order to provide clarity, a map was introduced into the official plans to show what that airport influence area was. The special policy areas were expanded in order to identify the special study area in and around the new Highway 6. Note that those lands were not redesignated at that time. They still retained their agricultural designation and their appropriate rural zoning designations, but it just outlined a process to do further study on that process. As part of that special policy area that was created, the redesignation of these lands would only occur at the time of under the existing regional official plan of a five-year review of the official plan. And finally, council directed staff to have consultation with the landowners within the Deferral 11 area in order to resolve that outstanding matter and make appropriate recommendations on land use for that area. Under the growth options, that area was shown as still having an agricultural designation and would in fact have urban land uses on three sides of it. We have the airport, the development along Upper James Street, and then the development north of 20 Road. Plus, you have a fair amount of rural residential development along Glencaster Road, and then you also have that special policy area to the west of that area. Intensification was looked at in greater detail in terms of coming up with the best estimate as to the amount of intensification that could occur, as well as where that intensification should occur. 26,000 units of the projected growth will be accommodated through residential intensification. A significant portion of that will be within the downtown setting sail area, although other intensification will occur within the former downtowns of the communities or along key node corridors throughout the city of Hamilton. The other consideration that we heard from the public in 2006 related to peak oil. For those who aren't familiar with peak oil, that's a situation where oil production peaks, and then we end up into a declining situation, which results in a scarcity and permanent higher energy prices. The consultant who was retained to do the peak oil study came back with a series of recommendations that aligned with the provincial policy statement in terms of how to plan for energy considerations. Those considerations are fostering vibrant centers, planning for a mix of land uses, aggressively pursuing brownfield development, giving greenfield development low priority, and arranging development to support low energy transit, i.e. public transit. These recommendations have actually already been incorporated into the grids process, and that very similar recommendations were identified at the beginning of the Transportation Master Plan during the policy paper stage, although at that time it was talking more about air quality, climate change, and reducing emissions. We brought all of those factors together, and then the recommended growth option is a modification of the nodes and corridor, but it provides for a reasonable level of intensification. It supports a vibrant downtown. It focuses growth around transit infrastructure. It reinforces the importance of the Hamilton International Airport. We're planning to develop compact, complete communities with a mixture of land uses, both in types of residential, single, semis, rows, and apartments, as well as residential and non-residential uses, commercial, institutional, within our communities. It directs development to areas with full servicing. We are avoiding protecting local natural features and green space, and it identifies and protects good movements corridors. The downtown is sort of a key node, and then we have a series of secondary nodes and tertiary nodes based on the ability of those nodes to accommodate growth and change over the next 25 years. Growth occurs in the urban area, both within existing areas and planned areas. of the 80,000 increased households in Hamilton between 2001 and 2031, only 725 will be in the rural area. The balance of that growth will be directed to the urban area, with the majority of that growth occurring within the existing urban boundary. The natural heritage system is protected based on the natural heritage system mapping and the policies that are currently being finalized as part of the OP work program. It provides for a better distribution of where we live and where we work in the city of Hamilton. At the present time, the majority of the employment is below the escarpment and the majority of the population is above the escarpment. Under this situation, that puts pressure on our escarpment crossings. And if we continue just to have residential growth on top of the escarpment, there could in fact be a need for a new escarpment crossing somewhere in the city of Hamilton. Instead, by providing a better balance between population and employment growth throughout the city, we can avoid that need for an escarpment crossing. That's facilitated by encouraging additional residential population in the lower city of the Hamilton, while ultimately encouraging more employment growth above the city on top of the escarpment. And finally, public transit and other modes of travel are supported and promoted with this strategy by connecting the identified nodes with a series of corridors that provide an alternative to the use of the private automobile for moving around the city of Hamilton. The recommendations are that no urban boundary expansion at this point in time, because we have sufficient both employment lands and residential lands within the urban area to accommodate growth in the short and medium term, subject to a resolution of some servicing and other constraints.
From the grid's presentation by staff 2006, we now go to a public presentation made by Michael Desnoyers, who is involved with Hamiltonians for Progressive Development. This group has been fighting the airport expansion boundary for 3 years. With all the changes that we have become aware of, the sudden acceptance that, yes, fuel has become too expensive, trucking companies and jet companies are going out of business, other companies that are related to the manufacturing of vehicles that use oil and gas have laid off or fired or let go of thousands of people. We are in a manufacturing job crisis right now because of the cost of fuel. Why would it make sense to continue to proceed with a five-year-old plan, if not longer, that didn't acknowledge the realities of what that high price would do to our society? Michael makes his points quite clear, especially at the end, that everywhere outside of Hamilton, there are news reports talking about the job losses, the cost of fuel, how hard it is to replace jet fuel. To push the urban boundary means to flout the Places to Grow Act, to base all our future job growth on trucking industries and jet companies as a cargo transit hub seems to be foolishness in light of what everybody else in the province and Canada and the rest of the world are saying about the high cost of fuel. And now here is Michael Desnoyers and his point of view about the urban boundary push out by the airport.
Michael Desnoyers. So as I put out, my challenge this evening is to try and convince 3 years of studies, reports, meetings, correspondence, and issues related to the planned or proposed development of lands around the airport in 30 to 40 minutes. Right? I'd like to start out by very briefly telling you a little bit something about HPD, or Hamiltonians for Progressive Development. HPD is a not-for-profit incorporated entity in the province of Ontario. We were formed in the summer of 2005 when it was principally to launch the OMB appeal to the city's plan to expand the urban boundary at that time. And it was to create what is known at that time as the Aerotropolis. That's the affectionate name for the area. What I'm not going to do is deal a great deal, or at least speak a great deal, about the Ontario Municipal Board. What I'm hoping is if you want to know about that, please ask questions at the end, all right? I think it suffices to say that the settlement was reached between HPD, the city, Tradeport, the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing. So we reached the settlement, and there was an order that was issued by the Ontario Municipal Board. So what I'd like to do is just read you three quick things from the position statement that we have on our website, which essentially sums up what HPD is all about. The principal mission of Hamiltonians for Progressive Development is to articulate and support the implementation of a progressive approach to city planning and development. We believe Hamilton will prosper if and only if we follow the principles underlying Vision 2020. We believe that economic prosperity is possible only when social and environmental objectives are actually implemented with each and every major development decision. This simple principle is at the heart of Vision 2020. We believe in the fundamental second principle of Vision 2020, and that is true community prosperity can only occur with broad community engagement in major municipal decisions. And I say broad community engagement, and that comes in many, many fashions. Now, HPD has a website. It's www.progressivedevelopment.ca. We create a quarterly newsletter. We sponsor and we co-sponsor public forums about relevant subject matter. Some of you may have attended the event with Richard Gilbert here, which we co-sponsored. And we are members of the Ontario Smart Growth Network. So we encourage you to visit our website and consider signing up as a supporter. And again, there's copies of this, and ironically, on the back is a sign-up spot where you can become a supporter of ours. But mostly important is there is a spot there. You can support us in many ways, and we're hoping that you can also help to support us financially. So that's quickly a little bit about HPD. So for the heart of the reason we're here this evening is to talk about the Airport Employment Growth District, which, as I pointed out earlier, is more affectionately known as the Aerotropolis. I would like to point out that HPD did not create that name, nor were we consulted in the creation of either one of these names. All right. I will explain shortly why that's important. In regards to the Airport Employment Growth District, where is it located? Why is it necessary? Where are we at right now, and how did we get there, or how did we get here? What's next? What are the possible implications to us in the city of Hamilton? And what can we do? All right, and I will avoid as much as possible giving you my opinions. It's very difficult to do that, right? Because I obviously have an opinion. But I'm going to try to avoid that. The information that I present to you comes entirely from city documents. And these documents are available to you at no charge. If you want these copies of this information, come see me. I'll tell you exactly where you can go and find them. Right? So it's important to understand that these facts come out of city documents. So if there's something distorted or wrong with these facts, we're in real trouble because that comes from city information. So I'm going to encourage you to seek out these documents and read them in their entirety. I think it's really important as residents of this community that we educate ourselves. And then we ask questions. It's important that you ask questions and demand the answers. Speak out, because you'll hear me say this a number of times this evening. What is perceived as acceptance is silence, right? And that, I think, is wrong. And we'll touch on that a little bit later. And this is a map of the area which identifies for you this study area. And I think it's important because a lot of people don't understand what are we talking about here and what is the size of it, the sheer size. If the city goes forward with this, it will be, reportedly, the largest single urban boundary expansion in the history of the city. The area that you have in the map in front of you that's bound by the purple line, this is the study area, or it's the proposed development for the employment lands. So I want to stress that this is a study area and that no changes to the urban boundary have occurred yet. Right? This is just a proposal. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you around that purple area so you understand where we're at. It will start in the upper left-hand corner up here. That is Fiddler's Green Road and Garner Road, or Highway 53. So when we travel east along Garner Road, we come to Garner Road. To Glancaster Road. And then we're going to turn south on Glancaster, and you essentially follow 20 Road, or down south of Glancaster until you get to 20 Road. Then we're going to go east along 20 Road to just past the villages of Glancaster. Some of you may recognize that. That's the adult lifestyle community, mostly retirement community. We do this little ditzy doodle. I call it a ditzy doodle because it really doesn't follow a road. That is the area. There's a golf range up in that area. And then what we're going to do is essentially come back to Upper James, and then we're going to follow Upper James south to essentially what is Airport Road, and then turn west along Airport Road. We're going to follow Airport Road again. It's not really a road, it's more of a geographic. We go south again, and it's just directly across from the airport. You may recognize in the corner, if you've been up in that area, there's a lot of residential development just across from the airport. So we're going to go south there again, all the way along to Whitechurch Road. And then we're going to go west along Whitechurch, up to Fiddler Stream, and then back up to Garner Road. So that essentially defines what is referred to as the study area. The entire area is approximately 7,800 acres, or 3,200 hectares. And I apologize, but this evening I'm going to be flopping back and forth between hectares and acres, because that depends on which study was conducted. But if you'd like to know how many acres there are in a hectare, or how many hectares there are in an acre, you either multiply or divide roughly by about 2.5. So I'll try to give you the conversions as we go along. Now, when you eliminate such things as the airport, inside that yellow line, that's the airport. If you eliminate that, if you eliminate hydro corridors, roads, the aero park, which is the airport industrial park, natural features like wooded lots, ponds, rivers, creeks, things of that nature, you end up with what is about 3,000 acres. So these 3,000 acres that are left, that is what is being contemplated as the employment lands. So that's what this study is all about, is those lands. So hopefully everybody's got a good picture in their mind of the area that we're referring to at this point. So let's go, that's the where title. So why is it necessary? Why do we have to study this area to create these employment lands? Well, back in 2005, the province of Ontario passed into law the provincial policy statement. That's this document here. It's available on the Ontario website, the Ontario government website. So this document, along with this one here, which is called the Places to Grow, or P2G, sets out the projections for growth in the province of Ontario to the year 2031. Now, the provincial policy statement sets out various policies that are going to be used or need to be used by municipalities to follow, and specific targets to follow to achieve what they're saying is going to be the projected growth for the entire province of Ontario. The Places to Grow document, this one here, specifically identifies Hamilton as an urban growth center. And it very, very specifically defines what that means. Right? And that as well is important, and I'll touch on that as well. Now, neither one of these documents specifically states that the airport or the lands that surround the airport should be the number one economic priority of the city. That's very key, because you often see in city documents and reports that it states that the province of Ontario has identified this as our number one economic priority. Nowhere, nowhere in these documents does it actually state that use. What it does say, to be fair, is that the lands around the airport should be protected from incompatible uses. Meaning, you don't put houses right next to an airport. Why? People that live underneath the flight path, then they complain about the noise. It's kind of like you don't put a house right beside farms, because we tend to complain about the smell. In these documents, the province projects that Hamilton will grow in population by approximately 150,000 people by the year 2031, from our current population. And everything starts based on 2001. And with that population, we have to create 90,000 new jobs in order to satisfy these people, that this population increase. Now, these projections, okay, and we all know how accurate projections can be at some times, are based on a study that was done in 2001 by a consulting firm called Hansen. These 90,000 new jobs that need to be created are further broken down into three categories. The very largest of which is called or referred to as employment type jobs. And it gets really confusing, but to make it simple, we're just going to call these industrial-type jobs. Because the three categories are office, essentially retail, wholesale, and industrial, or employment-type jobs. These lands are for employment-type jobs, or industrial-type jobs. Now, the city has to determine how much land is required in order for us to accommodate businesses that are going to create these jobs, these 49,000 jobs by 2031. So the city engaged Henson again, and you're going to hear Dillon and Henson come up a great deal. How much land was vacant?
Using a relatively simple mathematical equation, concluded that we don't have enough land in the city of Hamilton in order to meet the projections. And this was based on a particular density. And we used that, we said that we could find businesses that will create 37 jobs per hectare. So divide that by 2.54, or divide the number of acres by 2.54. But the objective is we have to put at least 37 jobs per hectare in order to meet these projections. There was a peer review done of this study, and it was done by a company called MKI in September of 2006, I believe. And what they concluded was that it was highly unlikely that we were going to be able to achieve that density of 37 jobs per hectare. And they suggested to the city that perhaps 31 jobs, or a smaller number, was more appropriate. That's really important to know. And I hope someone will ask me why when we get to the question session. But it's real simple mathematics here. We got 49,000 jobs that we need to create. And we have a demand of 1,670 hectares. Now, don't do the math, because it doesn't add up. And there's lots of reasons why it doesn't add up. We need 1,670 hectares of land for these 49,000 jobs. Now, the study that was conducted by Hamilton, they found 760 within the city limits that we can use. So they said we have a shortfall and that we need about 900 hectares more to create land so we can entice businesses to come here and create those jobs. So we're short 900 hectares of land. So why are we locating this around the airport? Throughout this whole provincial process, the city is actively planning to meet the needs that the province has projected. And we respond by creating this GRIDS. And for those of you who don't know what GRIDS means, it's Growth-Related Integrated Development Strategy. It's an acronym, right? Some of you may recognize it. The problem that we have with the GRIDS is that staff presented to council 5 or 6 options to meet these projections, but all 6 of them included this airport park. There were no alternatives. So staff said, that's where it's got to go. Council and the public really had no alternative choices to debate as to whether we felt that that was the right choice or not. Also recently, the city received a report, a study that was done by Hamilton. It was called the Comprehensive Employment Study, or Land Budget. One thing that it didn't do was it did not include any brownfields lands that are in the city in their calculations, despite the fact that just recently the city has identified over 4,000 acres of what they call sites of interest. And this was done in another study called the Historic Land Use Inventory. Now, the study was commenced in the fall of 2007 by Dillon Consulting, and it addresses numerous areas, such as the water and wastewater requirements for that area, stormwater handling, transportation, market potential, etc. Now, the draft study was released to the public in late May, and it was released to members of the Community Liaison Committee for input and feedback. Now, the CLC was ordered by the ONB. This 330-page Dillon report was put before council at the CAL meeting on June the 23rd, along with the land budget study, along with a comprehensive review study. So there was a lot of information that was presented to council in one day. The conclusion of this report, and I'm just going to read to you directly from the report. I don't want to be accused of being biased. It says that overall, Based on the land uses analysis, it was concluded that the development of the employment lands or the employment growth district is feasible and justified, and there is flexibility to achieve employment objectives while protecting natural and cultural heritage resources with the available land base for the airport employment growth district. So this basically, after about 6 to 8 months of study and a 340-page report, they've concluded that it is feasible. So we can go ahead and we can do this. Now, both the employment land budget and this phase one report were accepted by council on the 23rd at the COW meeting and subsequent council meeting of the 25th of June. Now, there's three major concerns that we as a group, HPD, have and others expressed at the COW meeting of the 23rd. This report in no way addresses the implications of an energy-constrained future and the rising costs of fuel to the economic viability of the airport or this industrial park. Approximately 69%, over two-thirds of the proposed land that are projected to be used by businesses such as logistics, warehousing, transportation, and wholesale trade, all very heavily dependent on the trucking industry. So despite the fact that we've got this huge issue in front of us of an energy-constrained future, otherwise known as peak oil, and that two-thirds of the land that will be used will be for things that are heavily transportation-related, none of this report addresses those concerns. Despite the huge amount of brownfields that have been identified by the city, there's virtually no significant amount of those 1,000 hectares that we need that have been included in the land growth needs or the budget that of land that we require. And thirdly, the report in no way addresses cost. There's enough evidence to suggest that the costs will be huge, but nothing is suggested how, what the number is, or how we're going to finance this. Now, staff, again, to be fair, have indicated that when we go into the phase two of the studies, that those specific issues will be covered off. Now, as I indicated, there's enough evidence out there available to roughly estimate what these servicing costs are going to be. For example, it has been published and reported that the estimated servicing costs for the North Glanbrook Business Park is approximately $50 million. Now, that's for 275 hectares of land. The Airport Employment Growth District is approximately five times the size of the North Glanbrook Park, so it's simple mathematics, and you really can't scale this, but simple mathematics would suggest that five times 50 million is 250 million. And the North Glanbrook Park doesn't have many of the obstacles present that exist at the Airport Employment Growth District. Now, it has been repeatedly stated by staff that all these costs will be covered by development charges. Now, the information I'm about to give you comes right out of this report. All right, I didn't create or make this up. Of the eight municipalities that are compared within this report for competitive analysis, including Hamilton, Hamilton had the lowest industrial development charges of the eight. That sounds contrary to the statement by staff that it's all going to be covered by development charges. And the cost per acre for service land in Hamilton is 2.5 times the cost of land in Brantford. But we are to believe that all the costs will be covered by development charges. Now, I can't tell you the number of times that I have been in meetings or presentations by city staff and have been reminded by them that how Hamilton is losing out and we're being bypassed by so many companies because we don't have shovel-ready serviced land. And one of the examples that they repeatedly use is that Procter & Gamble wanted to locate here, but we didn't have shovel-ready serviced land. That's not an entirely accurate statement. Up at the airport is the Aero Park. It's been serviced for over 10 years. Fact of the matter is that that land, principally, a large portion of it, is owned by a very prominent Hamilton businessman, and he wanted a certain value for that land. Procter & Gamble was unprepared to pay for that. Procter & Gamble, from a logistics standpoint, ideally should have been located in Milton. Milton has one of the highest, if you look at this chart, has one of the highest costs per acre. Where did Procter & Gamble chose to go? They went to Brantford. Money talks. That's where the land is the cheapest. What did they get? They got a warehouse distribution center. They used 45 acres of land. Or what, about, somebody give me some math, is about 20 hectares? About 20 hectares, approximately. And they created 300 jobs. That's a fact. So we said that we wanted 37 jobs per hectare. Most of the land used in this proposed development park will be for those kinds of businesses. They used up about 20 hectares and created 300 jobs. Well, 20 times 37 is a lot more than 300. But that's the kinds of industries we will principally attract to this industrial park. So what's next? At the COW meeting on the 23rd and the council meeting of the 25th, members of council voted in favor of accepting the findings of the employment land budget. They voted to accept this phase one study and allowed staff to proceed with negotiations for the detailed phase two study. Now, they accepted the land budget despite the fact that there essentially are no brownfield lands which were included in that budget, despite the objections of the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing. For those of you who don't think lightning can strike twice in the same place, that's exactly or essentially what happened at the council or the COW meeting of the 23rd. The day of the council or COW meeting, council was presented with a letter from the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing. That's this letter. It arrived to staff the Friday before. The COW meeting was on the Tuesday, I believe. Monday? It was on the Monday. And on the Friday before, or June the 20th, the ministry sent this letter to the city. Now, essentially, it's a five-page letter. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but essentially what it says is that the province does not agree with the final calculations of land requirements and essentially indicated that the city should not proceed without further consultation with the ministry and until we essentially get the number right. Council approved the budget. They approved the study. We're proceeding. It's under the understanding that staff is going to work with the province to get these little issues worked out. All right. Council essentially ignored the letter on advice from staff, so they're proceeding with phase two of the study. A very similar incident occurred in July of 2005 when council ignored a letter from the province, which is this one. They ignored this letter, which essentially said, don't proceed. They ignored it, and they ended up in a battle with the province at the Ontario Municipal Board, along with us. Now, the city is preparing to proceed with phase two of the study. Even though phase one did not even attempt to address the issue of cost, even in a superficial manner, nor did it take into consideration into its economic analysis the impact of the rapidly cost of rising fuel. A very positive outcome of the process is that Councillor McCaddy was able to add to the phase two terms of reference the need for investigation into energy impacts, but it's more from a citywide perspective as opposed to specifically related to the Aerotropolis. I should point out to you that Council agreed to such a follow-up study to the Gilbert report in April of 2006, and we're still waiting for the outcome of that report. 2 years later, they still haven't started that report. So will we get this report as part of this phase two study? One can only hope. So what are the implications? Now, the city's moving forward to the next phase of the study despite some obvious and serious deficiencies in the phase one report and to the objections of the province. The position of the city now is that the operation of the airport and the employment growth district are not connected and are separate. I'd like to point out to you the obvious fact, without trying to be too facetious or ridicule, that the first name that was coined for this area is the Aerotropolis, but there is no connection. And now it is referred to as the Airport Employment Growth District. Again, we didn't make that connection. In this report, I'd like to read to you, it says on page 85 of this report, at the bottom, while the focus of our analysis is on the market potential for lands which surround the airport, the current operations, employment activities, and expansion potential of Hamilton International Airport are closely tied to form and magnitude of employment growth within the Airport Employment Growth District. So this connection was made by the consultant. An entire section of this report deals with passenger and cargo projections. And if there's any doubt, on page 1, paragraph 1, sentence 1, it states that the City of Hamilton and the Province of Ontario recognize the importance of the John C. Munro Hamilton International Airport as an important economic driving force for the City of Hamilton. So this is supposed to be a land study. There's no connection, but that's what it states in the very first paragraph. So I leave it to you to make the decision as to whether there's a connection or not. There are some definite connections between the two, but an attempt is being made to distance them apart. You can ask the question why. The question that we need to ask, and you can phrase this or frame it in any way you want, because we're being told we're being negative when we ask this question. Is this a sound economic strategy given the current and probable future state of the world oil supply? And is it sustainable? So I want to read to you some headlines to help you answer some of those questions. Now, to address this concept that we're creating an intermodal hub, that's what this whole economic strategy is, to create an intermodal hub. And the vast majority of the employment area is going to be transportation related. So our economic development strategy is centered around air and truck. True to it, to be fair, we also have the port and rail, right? So there's both sides of the story here. A couple of air articles that I'll read to you. Here's one from tradingmarkets.com off the internet. It's something about the stock markets. And it was published on May the 25th. Trucking shifts to a crisis gear, and it's due to U.S. diesel prices. High fuel prices are crippling the airline industry and chopping into household budget, but no sector of the economy has been hit harder than the trucking industry. Here's another one. It was published on June the 6th. Fuel prices bankrupt truckers. It's a story about how over 900 trucking companies filed for bankruptcy in the first 3 months of 2008 in the United States. Now, that is 2% of the total trucking capacity in the United States. Now, we always tend to think this is only going to happen in the United States, that we're somehow isolated from this. Here's an article from April the 16th, and it's in the Star, Toronto Star. It says, truckers grapple with soaring fuel bills. And it says within the text of it, the body, one recent casualty was Hamilton's Mobile Cartage and Distributors, one of the city's oldest trucking companies that was founded in 1919, went bankrupt late last year. Trucking industry is going to be deeply affected by high price of fuel. Now, Hamilton International is the premier air cargo facility in Ontario and perhaps even Canada. So let's look at air cargo. What's going to happen to air, potentially what is going to happen to air cargo? Here's an article from a site called Air Cargo World. It's specifically about air cargo. And it was posted on June the 5th. Air freight traffic is down. The U.S. domestic air cargo traffic took a sudden steep turn downward in March, falling 5.5%, the largest decline in business in nearly 4 years. Here's another one from the dated April 16th. Air cargo volumes are down as jet fuel prices rise. That nationwide, air cargo has slipped to its lowest level in 4 years. We're going to be isolated from this in Hilton International. This is what we're being led to believe, because somehow we can do it cheaper. Here's something that's going to put a bit of a bone in that. Again, from the Star, June the 19th, airport will cut fees for cargo carriers. The operator of Toronto's Pearson International Airport plans to reduce its air cargo landing fees in an effort to win back lost business. That's going to put pressure on Hamilton International, because they're going to reduce their fees to compete more with smaller regional airports. So, it goes on and on. Here's an article about FedEx and UPS. We know UPS is one of the primary cargo carriers out of Hamilton Airport. And it talks about fuel surcharges. With the increasing fuel prices, the fuel surcharge from transportation providers continues to rise. In March of 2008, there was an additional 18.5% on an average overnight parcel package. Today, that's gone up to an additional 28%. So if you send something by courier, it's an additional 28% just because of fuel surcharges. At the COW meeting on the 23rd, it was suggested again that somehow Hamilton International would not be impacted, and that low-cost airlines like WestJet and Fly Globespan, who are the two principal passenger carriers into and out of Hamilton International, would somehow thrive. So here's a few headlines about airlines. Here's one from the Business Journal, the San Antonio Business Journal. It was published on Friday, June the 13th, that the caption is that U.S. airlines have never faced a darker future, the study shows. Now, since September of 2001, five of the six major carriers in the United States have gone bankrupt. The only one who hasn't declared bankruptcy, and some of them more than once, the only one who hasn't declared bankruptcy is American Airlines. And the experts actually say they should declare bankruptcy so they can be more competitive. It's estimated that American Airlines loses $3.5 million per day. Here's one from the Business Travel Coalition. The U.S. airline industry is headed towards catastrophe at current oil prices. Here's one from the chief executive officer of Air Canada's parent company. It's Robert Milton. It was published on June the 30th. This is just a couple weeks ago, by the Globe and Mail. Oil costs will kill bargain airlines. That this is truly a global issue, and I think you're going to see a lot of airlines disappear. The ones who are really going to have a problem are the airlines that are trying to sell a low-fare proposition. Right? So it's going to reshape the airline industry. Here's one from DWS Aviation. This is an aviation website. They're saying that oil prices may force many smaller airlines out of Europe to close down, and a report from the IATA, which is the International Air Transportation Association, that in all, 24 airlines have gone bankrupt around the world so far in 2008. And nearly half of them were based in Europe. And they cite Silverjet, MaxJet Airways, and EOS Airlines, which are all low-cost airlines that went bankrupt. This isn't just happening in North America. It's happening in Europe. Here's one from New Zealand. Airlines dive as oil prices soar. That was the end of May. Right. So the concept that low-cost airlines are not going to be affected by this, I think, is wishful thinking. We know that WestJet was modeled after Southwest Airlines. Right? Southwest Airlines is one of the most successful in the United States. Right. So this one here is published on June the 20th. And it was in the New York Times. My goodness, if they don't know, who doesn't? It says that high fuel costs are squeezing low-cost airlines or low airfares. That low-fare airlines aren't so low anymore. Golly gee, Thursday, June the 26th, just 6 days later, in the Washington Business Journal, Southwest Airlines to raise ticket prices. They can't combat the high price of oil. Specifically on June the 23rd, Ryanair was mentioned as, look at them. Look how well they're doing. Look how great that is. June the 3rd, in FinancialTimes.com, Ryanair prepares to raise prices. the chief executive, they've frozen their pace because their prediction is that this year they're going to barely break even.